My name is Louise Speer, and I have the pleasure of being the chair of this session. I know when I first got my program and I was reading through all the titles, I thought, what a variety of things happening at this conference. But when I saw the title, New Approaches to Recorded Sound, I thought, oh, I wonder what that's about. That sounds interesting. So I think we have a good session here. We've got King Tubby, we've got voice recognition software, something a lot of us don't know about, and a topic on ethnomusicology, which is of personal interest to me. So welcome, and I guess we'll get started right on time. Our first speaker is Brandon Burke, whom many of you already know, and those of you who don't know him so far, I'm sure will get to know him soon, since he's the chair of our AAA committee. So we all thank him very much. That's a big job, and the AAA will be doing some important work for ARSC and for the archiving community in general. You might not all know that Brandon got his BA in American Studies from the University of Kansas, 1998. No wonder he looks so young. And he also has an MLIS in Preservation Administration from the University of Texas in Austin. And he is currently the archivist for audio collections at the Hoover Institution Archives at Stanford University. He's been a past contributing writer to the All Music Guide. We maybe, even in the future, will read some of his articles there. And he's currently a contributing writer for Wax Poetics. And he's going to be speaking to us today on Recup Aversion King Tubby, Dub Reggae, and the Roots of Sampling. So, Brandon, I'll turn the podium over to you.
Thank you. First of all, thanks everybody for coming. I have a lot of material to try to blaze through here in pretty short order. Do I have a screen? Is that my fault? There we go. So I may be blazing through these slides pretty quickly. Also, there is a transcription of something that I'm going to be playing later that's being passed around. It'd be probably a good idea to try to read that. So without further ado, to be a true musical visionary is a rare thing indeed. In this century anyway, one thinks of John Cage, Harry Partch, Anthony Braxton. People that not only radically change the way sound is organized, they change the way that they changed the way that we understand the application of the very term organization as it applies to sound. These figures undoubtedly hold prestigious roles in the annals of music history, but others have made similarly genre-shattering and consequently genre-creating contributions, despite our seldom reading about them in music history texts. This is the story of Osborne Ruddock, otherwise known as King Tubby, the dub organizer. Dub is a subgenre of Jamaican reggae music whose earliest manifestations appeared around 1967. In short, it can be defined as a situation wherein recording engineers manipulate the playback of original multi-track recordings by potting up faders, panning different tracks, and applying psychedelic effects such as delay and reverb, all in time and in reaction to the tempo and the arrangement of the original recording. Sounds like a remix, doesn't it? It should, because the first generation of dub engineers invented the remix as we know it today. Dub was a watershed moment in music history for a number of reasons. Regardless of one's feelings about contemporary forms such as rap, house music, techno, or let's face it, modern disco, the fact remains that nowhere in the course of modern popular music production did these traits occur prior to the advent of dub. Examples of dub's contribution to contemporary music include engineers and producers emerging from behind the boards to become a singles credited artist, a situation central to hip-hop and dance music production. To say nothing for using already completed, that is, already thought to be finished, legacy documents of our musical heritage as instruments in their own right. There were predecessors, of course, Pierre Schaeffer, Steve Reich's early tape manipulations, and Terry Riley's outright looping of the regional Soul 45, You're No Good, by Harvey Averne for his piece of the same name in 1967, and likewise for volumes 4 and 6 of John Fahey's Tacoma discography. These are some examples among many. Dub, though cut from the same cloth, has its beginnings in a decidedly popular tradition, however, that of the party DJ. This is to say that where Reich and Company produce music both by and for an audience informed by Occidental high art culture, dub was merely an attempt to nice up the dance floor, as the saying went. In any case, it can be safely argued that unlike the examples here, the technical, to say nothing for aesthetic, innovations dub engineers introduced to the world were the product of a very real, very street-level need to offer a superior product, which in this case is the hottest dance party on the block. In order to fully grasp this situation, one must have an understanding of sound system culture. Sound systems are the means by which most Jamaicans in the poorer parts of Kingston, that is, the majority of Kingston, heard new music in the 1960s and 70s. Concerts were too expensive and were largely limited to resort areas, to say nothing for the fact that Rastafarian culture was not exactly welcomed in this latter environment. And I'm talking more about the 70s at this point. Sound systems are large outdoor parties with enormous PA systems. The popularity of a particular sound system rests largely on two variables: the quality of the system itself, that is the speakers, amplifier, etc., and the quality of the tunes. About the first, because sound system events are outside and bass frequencies travel poorly in such conditions, not only were systems designed to compensate for this problem, but the records played at these events were themselves mixed with a greater emphasis on bass frequencies. This will be something that will take off and soar once the dub era really comes to shine. Second, and equally paramount, were the songs themselves. In fact, competition was so fierce among rival systems that record selectors created alliances with local record labels as a way to assure that their sound system had exclusive access to particular songs, usually before they got pressed for commercial issue. And here I'm talking about buying instantaneous lacquer recordings a day or two after a song was produced, so you could play it that night at a sound system. Removing labels from 45s and replacing them with false labels was also common, as was inserting moles into rival systems to find out what the competition was playing. To be sure, the situation was far from a joke, and violence was very common. It's important to mention here that arrangements from songs already commercially issued are fair game for reuse in Jamaican music culture. Not only does this constitute the reuse of an original song's arrangement, it might very well involve the re-employment of that song's very same recording session. In other words, recording sessions were likely to be used multiple times for altogether different songs with altogether different lyrics. More important, however, was the fact that rival record companies were free to use popular arrangements, and let's say Smokey Robinson's Tears of a Clown will be our example here to put it in a U.S. Perspective, using these as launching pads for countless new songs, again with completely different lyrics. The concept of a version. Dub is the direct descendant of the version. Accounts vary as to how exactly the first version came to pass, but everyone agrees that Ruddy Redwood played the first version at a sound system after having a mastering engineer had a difficult time removing the entirety of a vocal track for a lacquer he had purchased earlier that day for a sound system. To say that the response from the crowd was positive would be an understatement. Versions became popular in no time, enough so that in order for a 45 RPM single to be considered legit in the commercial marketplace, it needed to have a remixed, quote-unquote, version on the B-side for play at sound systems. As this situation progressed, rhythm tracks were given greater emphasis at mixdown, and engineers began pulling in and out the other instrumentation, guitar, piano, horns, you name it, often creating several mixes, that is, several new arrangements of an original song in one afternoon, which were then cut into lacquers and played at sound systems, having created them themselves this time. Which brings us to King Tubby. Electronics technician for Treasure Isle Studios, mastering engineer and selector for King Tubby's hometown hi-fi, without question the most sonically revolutionary sound system of its day. Tubby used his acute engineering skills to manipulate proprietary sound equipment to desired effect, and also created elaborate systems of his own, such as his famous homemade tape delay system, built by combining two different tape machines as a means of both emulating and surpassing the delay capabilities of the Echoplex, a tape-based echo machine common in most Western developed nations, but not so much in Jamaica. King Tubby's wizardry introduced a noticeable improvement in fidelity, both in the sound system yard and on record. His mixes exhibited greater dexterity at the controls, including swifter, more frequent use of faders and knobs, and in the next slide we're going to see an example of this, and employed multiple conflicting delay rates, among other things. He also introduced engineer-centric sounds such as sample test tones, which will play in later to my idea that this is a meta music, a music about engineering. Okay, in this clip, Prince Jammy is dubbing a then-new Junior Reed song. Keep in mind that you're hearing only the tracks that Prince Jammy is potting up in the mix. This is a master reel of a completed pop song, vocals and all. And again, let's use the Motown thing and just picture in your mind Tears of a Clown and imagine what you're not hearing from Tears of a Clown in this example. Of particular interest to me, anyway, if you pay close attention, is Prince Jammy actually pots a fader down rather than up to apply delay, which is further evidence, I say, of tweaking on the part of Tubby, who built the console that you're about to see.
Funnily, he works out of the great King Tubby studio, number 18 Jumbly Avenue in Kingston 11. King Tubby built his first amplifier in 1962, and in the late 60s, he built the biggest sound system on the island. His hometown, King Tubby's Hi-Fi, became the most revolutionary sound system of all time. His greatest innovation was the introduction of German bass versions on the flip side of every record. And this was how dub was born.
Well, this one is a new crew release by Junior Reed. It's called Jailhouse Rock, produced by Prince Jammy. Go ahead and start.
Dub is the instrumental rhythm track, an unobstructed rhythm without words, with the emphasis on the bass. Sound effects and echo in particular are used a lot. It is a naked dance rhythm, and the engineer and the producer have become the acknowledged artists of dub.
Clip ends. Now that we've had a chance to see this process in action, we're going to play a little before and after. So you're going to hear two clips on this one. The first is a very popular song at the time, Baby I Love You So by Jacob Miller. It's going to be followed by a tune credited to Augustus Pablo that was actually recorded by King Tubby, but Tubby is of course credited in the title of the song, King Tubby's Meets Rockers Uptown, considered by many to be the pinnacle of first-generation dub engineering. I invite you to pay particular attention to how Tubby used delay to affect double time in the hi-hats and snare when you compare one to the next, and used faders to create a new instrumental arrangement. You're going to hear guitar come in and out of the mix, but of course guitar was playing the entire time. And also the way that he only hinted at the original vocal track. So we're going to play Jacob Miller first, followed by the King Tubby version. When it was in the hands of King Tubby, who at this point in time did a remix when there was no such thing as a remix. Okay, for our next example, this one is not mixed by King Tubby, but rather by Clive Chin of Randy's studio. In this one, a fictitious studio boss explains the workings of dub to a would-be assistant. This example serves a few purposes. First and most obviously, it's a play-by-play account of the mixdown process when making a dub. Secondly, it provides further evidence that dub was, at its core, a music very much about the process of engineering music. And don't forget, as you're listening to this, that other than my fading it out and fading it in to cut time, this song was issued as is, with false starts and all. And it wasn't issued as a novelty record. It was a really great-selling record of its own. So, and provided for you is a transcription of this. So you may want to grab that piece of paper. And with that, I give you Ordinary Version, Chapter 3.
What the nylon cloth you are doing on my shoulder, sir?
It's just like say, Mr. Tino, for go on, so you know, sir. I man just come for beg you a little job, you know.
You can't do operating work, sir?
Why, right now, I can't operate, but I will cooperate with you. I will do anything.
All right, I'm going to show you. See the bass button, yeah? Forward the bass there, sir. You see, I'm sure the bass and you forward the guitar.
Well, why do you not say that for me a chance?
Give a chance. Give a chance. Leave the shooter, sir. Leave the shooter. Just leave the shooter, sir.
Right, right, no. Still a big, you know, sir.
Leave the shooter, sir. Oh, slide on with him.
Right now, I'm gonna go show you how to operate, right? Watch the bass now. You hear the bass now, it sound wrong. You saw it, watch, just listen to the bass. You saw it make the girl them a wiggle them waist. All right, listen to the drum then. Them drum, they will make you dumb in the eye. Right? Listen to the guitar them now. Listen to everything now.
Slide down with it.
Do it.
That's pretty fun, right? So now we're going to talk about dub as a predecessor of hip-hop culture. Very certainly, Jamaican selectors, who I mentioned earlier were the guys who were buying acetates from these record labels, are today's hip-hop DJ. And not only that, but you just saw Prince Jammy earlier putting down a mix, which very much is what a hip-hop DJ does today. Whereas today, it's, you know, mixers and turntables. With them, it was faders and knobs. And Jamaican DJs, strangely enough, are hip-hop rappers. So given what we've seen here, it's fair and accurate, actually, to consider American hip-hop a direct descendant of dub, the crucial link being DJ Kool Herc, whose family moved to the Bronx from Kingston in 1967. Herc is widely recognized as the first to isolate and repeat breakbeats using two turntables. And I don't know if you know what a breakbeat is. Some people do and don't. That would be the funkiest part of a funky record, usually the absolutely stupid, ridiculous drum fill in a Take a James Brown song, for example. So when this happens, what these guys were doing, especially back in the 70s, was they would isolate that one moment on that track, usually with a marker, so you would know how to find it when it was done, and have a mixer and isolate it on this other machine as well. It was pretty janky in these early days, but what you would do is create the same drum fill back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, which of course was the creation of the hip-hop beat. So the important things to take away from this thing, oh, that's okay, I don't need you. No. Okay, dub in the forms that spawned. The engineer as credited artist. Obviously with techno and things like that where you create music on a computer, you know, but these guys were you know, the first to do that with analog recordings, saying nothing for having done it, built entirely out of legacy works. And again, I'm going to go back to this idea about music, about the process of engineering. So again, this meta situation. saying nothing for the very concept of a remix, which is really something that's difficult to pry away from because it's so easy to think the remixes have been around forever, and that usually a remix involves, you know, 14 different Pro Tools tracks in a row where you can undo something if you want. These guys did everything on the fly, analog, and if they goofed, well, it was going to end up on that acetate master. And so finally, that sampling as we know it was not born in a vacuum. In reality, it spawned from a culture where it was a perfectly reasonable thing to do. And do I have time or no?
You do have.
Really? I'm going to show one more clip, if that's okay. I don't know if I can. If it'll let me show this, I'm going to show it, just because it's fun. Maybe? No, maybe it won't. That's unfortunate. Okay, well, anyways. I have some lists of recommended listening and some some books as well, and I'm happy to copy any of this stuff for you. It's hard to write this down. But certainly these compilations here are a great place to start. And as it happens, this book here, Michael Veal, Dub Soundscapes and Shattered Songs in Jamaican Reggae, I've not had a chance to read because it came out in the last week. But as it happens, it's for auction in the other room. So don't outbid me. And that's all I have. Thank you. It came from a BBC documentary called Deep Roots Music.
Is that available?
It's available as a Region 2 DVD, and I believe only a Region 2 DVD, yeah.
Okay. We do have a few minutes for questions, and I see we have a wireless here.
You'll forgive me for boggling the names, but the chap who moved to New York City and brought the sound system culture there,
right.
Are there direct links between that fellow and the early rappers? Or
certainly, because he was bringing this concept of setting up huge speakers in a basketball court and two turntables and a mixer and having these outdoor parties, and Jamaican DJ culture, and DJs I didn't really have a chance to get into, but those are the guys that it was called toasting over a record. So you'd have your selector playing music in the background and a DJ would be talking over it, which is a predecessor of rap. So, I mean, it's very literally a one-to-one correspondence.
Hello. Are people still doing this in Jamaica today? Are they still doing these same kind of techniques? Or are they using different kind of equipment now? Or is this genre still existing today?
I think it's largely a digital thing at this point.
Okay, so it's all computer-based now?
I think so, okay. Yeah. I mean, certainly if you buy... There's some of these guys from the first generation are still around. You know, there's a guy by the name of Lee Scratch Perry, which I didn't even get to, who's equally as important as Tubby, probably. Mm-hmm. But a little more kitchen sink about it, and less of a... I want to say true engineer, but he's still producing records. Those are largely digital at this point.
Okay.
And in fact, Tubby moved to digital shortly before his death in the late 80s.
Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
All right, thank you.
You mentioned how these sound systems are really competitive. Has that competition sort of been subsumed by copyright control at all, or is that an issue today in dub?
In Jamaica?
Yeah.
It's not an issue necessarily.
Is it an issue, though, on this side where there might be, you know, copyright claims that are made? Is it affecting the music?
Well, this is music. They're dealing with music that was made in Jamaica. I'm not sure that I understand.
I was just wondering if some of the competition or some of the competitive that competitive impulse had been subsumed at all by the nature of copyright control in the past decade and the way it has come on so strongly and in some ways destructively. Is it keeping music like that from being made maybe not only in Jamaica but also here?
Well, you can make the argument for here, certainly. But I mean, a lot of what these guys do is reuse instrumental tracks that they produce themselves. Right? So let's say, again, if we use the Motown example, we would take Tears of a Clown, and then Berry Gordy would find this amazing woman vocalist from Detroit, and she would come in and sing something over Tears of a Clown, but it would be called Because I Love My Baby. So with that, there really is no copyright situation to worry about. Now, the other labels using other arrangements, I've never been able to wrap my brain around how they let that go for as long as they did. But even today, if you go to a reggae record store, you know, they don't list their 45 singles by artist. They list them by rhythm. So whatever the first song is that ever used that, again, let's say Tears of a Clown, you go to the Tears of a Clown section and will, without exaggeration, find 40 or 50 different recordings, you know, that might be called Baby I Love You So, might be called Tears of the Brown, might be called anything like that. Is that?
Yeah.
Okay.
Hi, Brandon. I'm Jamie Madden from the State Archives of Florida. And I was wondering, when saying that kind of hip hop comes out of this Jamaican tradition, and you mentioned toasting, I wonder if you think that, you know, it might be more varied than that, because certainly toasting and signifying and playing the dozens and things like that are, you know, really a part of the African-American tradition and even the Caribbean African tradition. Do you think that this is just kind of another inroad to what led to hip-hop eventually, and that those other things are early kind of rap traditions as well?
They obviously are. Yeah, you're right. Absolutely. I'm still going to make the claim, though, that if we're talking about step one to step 950, this would be 45 to 46. There's just a very succinct connection right there. But you're right, it's a considerably grander tradition than I'm allowed to bring up in 20 minutes, I suppose.
Brandon, where are the big reggae collections or reggae archives, and do they have any job openings?
You know, I wish I could say that I knew about some great institutional reggae collections. Part of the reason I was talking about this is because I want to garner some interest in these types of recordings. Because often, as I was talking about with these guys buying lacquers or acetates, whatever you want to call them, it's common, I've seen this before, to go into a used record shop to find an unlabeled acetate record, and I'll be able to play it. Of course, I'm playing it on a janky stereo, so I'm ruining it as I want to find out what it is. But it's an unmarked dub acetate, and I haven't the slightest idea what it is. But these things are flying around everywhere, and it could have been a tubby mix, and it's very likely going to fall apart and die because nobody knows what it is. And that's true. In fact, they're the ones that issued the King Tubby Meets Rockers Uptown record.
So I think they've got a pretty good collection.
That could be. The interesting thing being, because so many of these dubs are acetates, who knows how many were made. You know, they could fire off 12 of them in an afternoon of one song, and then another original song may have two dubs. But, you know, they... And if you've seen photographs, I wish I had one, of some of these studios, Channel One Studio and Randy's Studio and Studio One, there's magnetic tape poured all over the ground coming out of boxes. It's a pretty awful situation from a preservation standpoint. So.
Would you also say, Brandon, as a tradition, though, it wasn't, they didn't necessarily think of it as something archival, because as you point out, it's a very fierce competition, and what was fresh last week is not going to be new and janky this week, except to use the terminology.
Yeah.
So they very much felt like it was an evolving genre, and they wanted to kind of be trendsetters and trailblazers. And
agreed. And not only, and I'm saying less so artistically and more so because you wanted to have the hottest sound system, or no one was going to come to your dance anymore. And of course, when this moved to record and outside of just sound system culture, then I think obviously the fact that it was an art was maybe given more, you know, consideration.
Okay, maybe one more quick question, and then we'll move on to the next speaker.
Hi, you mentioned if you go into a record store today in Jamaica that the 45s are arranged by rhythm.
Even in New York.
Okay,
yeah.
Are we talking about vinyl 45s or another format?
Talking about vinyl 45s.
Really, they're still pressing them.
Yeah, and as they press them, you won't find a 45 that isn't the original vocal version, Tears of a Clown. Other side just says nothing but version.
Right.
It's going to be the dub, yeah.
Right, now that I've seen that over the years,
yeah.
But I didn't realize that they were still, it was still based on the vinyl 45.
It is.
Great.
Okay, thanks. That was great, and I'm sure maybe some people will want to ask more questions after the break. So we're going to move on to our next speaker, who is Sonia Yacko, and she is a reference archivist at the Wisconsin Historical Society, and she will receive her Master of Arts from the School of Library and Information Studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison later this month, so she'll be a new graduate. For the last 20 years, Ms. Yacko has been the president of Anlex Computer Consulting, which specializes in databases, data structures, and search engines for digital and textual information management. So she's going to speak for us this morning on the potential for use of voice recognition software in appraisal of oral history tapes. So we'll give her a second to set up, and whenever she's ready, we'll move ahead.